Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, December the 6th, 2021, and Mondays have become good and evil tax discussion days with my partner in this venture, Jimmy Sexton, who is in Dubai and is the founder and chief executive officer of the Esquire Group. And if there's anybody listening to this for the first time, a man by the name of Charles Adams published a book in the early 90s called For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. And it's kind of like this: as goes taxes, so goes civilization. And I guess I would add, as goes civilization, so goes history. So one way of looking at this is, yes, as go taxes, so goes history. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Welcome, Jimmy. How are you today?
I'm fantastic, John. You know, I think that this is, I'm reading this, going through this book. And this has got to be, in my opinion, as somebody who's as passionate about taxes as I am, and I know you are, this has got to be one of the greatest books ever written.
Jerry, I would have to tell you, I agree with you completely. I have never met a single person. I mean, there almost nobody would pick this up if you just looked at the title. But once people pick it up, I have never met a person who did not agree with that. And it is such an amazing a piece of research. And, I encourage everybody to go out and get it. Again, it's called For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on Civilization. And just to bring everybody into this, so what Jimmy and I are doing is, in the second to last chapter, Mr. Adams sort of summarizes his thinking from the book in 27 interesting lessons. And I think everybody's heard the phrase, if you don't learn the lessons from history, you're bound to repeat them. And what I'm finding amazing in our discussions that Jimmy is how we're just talking about this from a contemporary point of view and seeing that, well, nothing has changed. It looks like people haven't learned any of these lessons.
And you know what I just find so fascinating, right, is the writing is so on the wall, because when you read this book, civilization after civilization just topples because of oppressive taxation. And they just keep making the same mistakes over and over again. They just can't help themselves. It's almost like they say the law of nature is what the strongest survivor, whatever it is. But I think the real law of nature is people just want to tax. It's unbelievable.
Well, yeah, I think. It's amazing stuff. Maybe the history of taxation should be something like, how do you get other people to pay your bills in a legal way or something like that? It's amazing stuff.
At the end of the day, taxation for the most part boils down to greed, right? When you read through this book, it makes it clear, especially when you start talking about the old Greek system where I think they had like a 3% tax or something that worked very well. It was sort of, there was this minimal taxation, sort of hands-off laissez-faire type economy where people kind of managed themselves. It's very prosperous. And the government got enough money to provide the basic services that were needed for a society. But beyond that, whether it's an emperor or a government or whatever, they just take the money to improve their own lives at the expense of other people.
One of the most amazing manifestations of that is if you look at what's going on with this Build America Back, was it Build Back Better?
Yeah.
This massive spending bill in the U.S. So the Democrats, as we all know, have got control of the administration, the presidency, Congress, and really the Senate, because the vice president gets the tie-breaking vote. And really, Build Back Better is essentially this massive tax bill. And there was a great article in The Economist last week saying, when it's all said and done, what the Democrats are probably going to do all they're really going to accomplish is, you know, is get their SALT deduction back to $80,000 from $10,000. You know, and that's it. I mean, the hypocrisy is unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah. It's how can those in government manage to benefit themselves at the expense of everybody else? Or to put it another way, to come back to my theme, how to get, you know, so what the Democrats are doing by raising the SALT deductions, essentially figuring out how to get other people to pay their bills.
Yep. That's the whole deal.
Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. And this is a party that campaigned on the platform of tax fairness.
Yeah. So I think, John, I think talking about the Democrats and political parties and those serving in government is a great lead in to the lesson that we're talking about
today. It absolutely is. It's an excellent segue. And here we go. Here is lesson seven today. All citizens, from recruits in the military to the chief leaders of society, should serve the state unselfishly and, if possible, without pay, motivated by a love for their country and the obligation to serve. Their primary reward should be the praise they receive from fellow countrymen for a job well done. Oh my God, let's read that again. Nobody would ever see that, an idea like that today. Here we go. All citizens, from recruits in the military to the chief leaders of society, should serve the state unselfishly and, if possible, without pay, motivated by a love for their country and the obligation to serve. Their primary reward should be the praise they receive from fellow countrymen for a job well done. Jimmy, have you ever heard of a politician who wanted to hold public office without getting a pension?
Well, I mean, publicly, all of them. realistically, no. I mean, look. I mean, I think what it is it in the U.S. I mean, forget about normal federal employees. I remember reading this article a while back, like on the health package and the health and retirement package that U.S. congressmen and senators get, and it's ludicrous.
Well, it's certainly far better than, you know, somebody who's not a public employee would get. You know, I mean, this is an interesting, I wouldn't call it an issue, but there was discussion of this recently in Canada had a federal election. And so once you serve in the Canadian Parliament for a certain number of years, I think it's 6 years, but I may be wrong on that. It's in that area anyway. You know, you get a lifetime pension, right? So there was actually some discussion before the last election, because under parliamentary system, the Trudeau Liberals were actually able to call the election. There was some discussion about the impact of the election date, right? On whether certain people in parliament would be able to get their pensions or not. I mean, this is over the top.
I mean, for 6 years of work, I mean, that's a far cry from their primary reward being the praise they receive from fellow countrymen for a job well done.
Yeah, I think it probably is. In fact, I'm not so sure they're getting praise for much of anything. I mean, the way the whole political system has unfolded is that most of these people we're talking about getting pensions, these backbencher MPs in Canada, are actually completely irrelevant other than as a vote for the party sort of thing. So, you know, or another interesting example, I know somebody who has been self-employed his whole life, you know, and you and I both know what self-employment is like. It's up, down, sideways, you know, blah, blah, blah. But certainly not a pension, okay, that's for sure. Certainly not a pension. So this person's mother had, you know, a relatively low level job with Canada Post, works there for, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, 30 years or 35 years or something like that. And now has a guaranteed retirement pension that is far beyond what her son gets as a self-employed person for, you know, 30 years. I mean, this is amazing, isn't it?
No, I mean, look, I mean, let's take the postal workers in the United States. I mean, I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and say this is, you know, one of the, this is a group of fairly close to worthless employees I've ever come across. I mean, I've never gotten good service in a post office.
Worth less than the mail they deliver?
Oh, for sure. And I mean, you got to look. I mean, these guys, you know, I mean, they get all kinds of breaks. I think they, you know, they work, you know, nine to five. They, you know, they're not working a bunch of overtime or anything. And then they get like a full government pension when they die. I think their wife or spouse takes over the pension. They get full medical benefits. You know, for a job that I remember when I used to live in the United States, I used to intentionally pay for FedEx just because I hate the post office so much, because they're just so worthless and impolite. You'd think for that cush job they got, they would at least treat the rest of us that are paying for their salary nicely.
Well, you know, probably true, but probably, and this is my fault for introducing it, probably a bit of an overreach to, you know, equate postal workers who are, you know, just trying to do a job with, you know, these members of various legislatures, you know, who, you know, who get these, you know, I think absurd pensions.
Sure. Well, and I mean, let's not just talk about the pensions, right? But let's talk about, you know, all of the other benefits that they get with their staffs and travel and use of government resources. That, I mean, I think if you look at the fringe benefits of being a congressman and a senator and add that up into the compensation, I mean, and the retirement package and everything else, I mean, that's a great, great gig.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely tremendous. Somehow or other, this moment, as you mentioned this, I mean, that's certainly, it's, I think it's probably more true today than perhaps it was, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, which, you know, my mind now moves to the death of Senator Dole over the weekend, who at, you know, the age of 98, seemed to me that he had a career in public service. Well, I mean, I became aware of him in the 70s, and so I guess obviously before that, right? I mean, would that be 50 years or more?
Yeah.
In public service. I mean, do you know? I mean, do you think that things were as bad 50, 60 years ago as they are today?
No, you know, I mean, look, I wasn't around 50, 60 years ago when this stuff, you know, but I think that a lot of it is, I mean, my impression from what I've been told from talking to people and books I've read and stuff like that, I think the political system in the United States in the 50s and 60s was much more, I think you really did have people that wanted to do a civic duty and do right for their fellow citizens and try to improve America. And I'm not saying that some of those people don't exist today as well, but I think the vast majority are doing it to put themselves in a position to get, you know, a good job with the private interests that are sponsoring them once they're out, if they're out. Doing, you know, it for,
or
the pension.
You know, or these pension benefits. I mean, I actually, it occurred to me going back to this thing in Canada that, you know, one of the things that should be clear on a ballot is whether voting for the person will lock in a lifetime pension at the expense of the taxpayers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. It is absolutely crazy. I mean,
does the average Canadian citizen even, are they aware of the types of benefits that your politicians get? Because I know in the United States, you know, I think people know that, you know, congressman makes like 60 grand a year or something, and they're completely oblivious to all, everything else that, you know, all their other benefits.
No, I don't think they do. I mean, it's not as though, you know, I mean, this is not the subject of much public discussion at all. I mean, I think that there's a genuine, you know, sort of a general sense of corruption entitlement, and that they're getting more than they deserve, and certainly more than any hardworking person would get. You know, I think there's certainly that. But in terms of the specifics, no, I mean, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, tax legislation, right? I mean, you know, even a dog knows whether he's been kicked or tripped over, right? And, you know, I think that the general public knows they're being kicked really hard, that this is not accidental, but, you know, how can they even begin to formulate why, right?
Yeah.
You know,
well, I mean, it almost seems to me like, you know, a serving a term in Congress should be like jury duty, right? You get $8 a day and you just got to go in there, and it's just part of your civic duty.
I agree with you. I mean, this is a question I think we might usefully ask. And I remember asking this question many years ago. And, you know, the question was a simple one. Why should elected politicians, be they congressmen or, you know, parliamentarians here and wherever, you know, why should they be paid at all? I mean, I think that this is something that, you know, Mr. Adams is raising, you know, in lesson number 7. Why should they be paid?
Well, they shouldn't, right? Because you can't call something public service if you're being paid to do it, right? If it's public service, you're doing it out of the goodness of your heart because you're passionate about it. Now, I get it that there needs to be some type of mechanism to allow these people to pay their bills and eat, right? If they're going to go perform a public service for no pay. But I think that goes back to like a jury duty thing, right? Like, you know, maybe your employer's got to foot the bill for the year while you're away, or there has to be some type of mechanism. But there should not be such a thing as a career politician, right?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think that term limits are absolutely essential for any functioning democracy. I feel very strongly about that.
Yeah.
You know, for no other reason. I mean, you know, we're talking here so far on a relatively high level of Congress or Canadian Parliament or something. But I mean, let's look at this, within the sort of arena of municipal politics, right, where, you know, just the very fact of serving, you know, for 20 years and having your name around, you know, gives you such a head start in an election. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I think it's extremely, I mean, I realize that some people would argue that as long as they can be voted out, that it's sort of democratic. But I think that without term limits, having these people around and all the free advertising for so many years makes it much, much more difficult to get rid of.
Well, I mean, not just that, right? But all the relationships that they build with the private interest groups and big companies and stuff like that over years and years and years, you know, it just gives them more and more power. And that makes them a more and more reliable political operative for the people that are behind them. I mean, I definitely think that, you know, public service, as you said, should just be that. It should be a public service. You should be required to do it, and you shouldn't get any money for it.
You know, I have seen from time to time candidates say, almost always independent candidates or small party candidates, right? Say, you know, if elected, I promise to donate my pay back to the community. Okay. And, you know, I look at this and, well, because I've known some of these people personally, I actually know they are sincere. Okay. I mean, I know they're sincere. But I think that people have gotten so cynical, they look at that and they say, no, that's just, you know, an election ploy. Obviously, they're lying.
Well, I mean, isn't that the sad part, though, that just when you see whatever a politician's saying, you just think they're lying?
Well, I think that is very sad. I think that's a very, very serious problem. And I think that, you know, I think that as government gets bigger and bigger, the disconnect between elected officials and their constituents gets bigger and bigger. And, you know, hence there, you know, there's just no trust. I mean, very few people, at least in my part of the world, have any trust at all in government. You know, think they get any value from their elected representatives. And
well,
I don't know if that was always the case, but it's clearly the case now.
Well, you know, I remember when I was in undergrad, and I was in a business ethics class. And we were talking about the ethical responsibility of the board of directors of companies. And what it was basically, what it was saying is the sort of classic view was that the board of directors of a company had a duty to maximize the profits and do what's in the best interest of the shareholders. And that when it came to public companies, that had sort of morphed over the years, that the board of directors of public companies had a ethical duty to do what was in the best interest of the corporation as a business, rather than what was in the best interest of the shareholders. Although the thinking was that the two were often aligned. If you did what was in the best interest of the business, eventually it would be what's in the best interest of the shareholders. And I think we have a very similar thing going on here, where you have this disconnect between politicians and their constituents, because although the constituents are electing the politicians are doing what's in the best interest of the government, not what's in the best interest of their constituents, which is, I think, how the political system was designed to be, but it doesn't operate like that anymore.
Yeah, that is certainly true. And that, of course, has been exacerbated by in the United States, as far as I can tell, politics has only been a two-party game, Democrats and Republicans. In Canada and many other countries, you know, there are more political parties. And there's also, I think, although weak, I think a stronger tradition generally of, you know, independent candidates, right? So, you know, independent candidates, at the very least, have permission to and are expected to represent their constituents. But once they become candidates for a particular political party, that really is not the case at all. And it's a very interesting dynamic. I mean, I've actually run as a candidate, as an independent candidate, times over the years. So, you know, I found myself on a debate stage, you know, with representatives of various political parties.
I would have loved to have watched that.
Well, the basic dividing line is this, okay, that independent candidates are responsive and should be to their constituents. And as you point out, candidates of major political parties are for the most part, okay, certainly more so in Canada than the United States. You know, I mean, they're responsive to what the party wants. I mean, you know, in a very real sense, they're a complete waste of money.
Yep.
I mean, you'd almost be better off just saying, well, you know, their salaries are relevant. Just give it back to the community.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, so this is the direction that we've moved and that we continue to be going. And I think that things are likely to get an awful lot worse before they get better. I mean, the partisanship is so toxic now. It's as though the purpose of politics is to engage in war against the other party. I mean, there seems to be no sense whatsoever of any common good anymore.
Yep, it's very true. Well, I mean, the United States, I think, is probably, like everything, they do it better than everybody else. But I think you see this even when you look throughout Europe and stuff, you know, the political parties have just gotten so vicious towards one another that it's just getting worse and worse around the globe.
I think it definitely is, but I think it gets very much exacerbated in a two-party system.
Oh, for sure. I mean,
100%. At least if you've got, you're what, a citizen of Austria or?
Germany.
Germany. So if you're voting in Germany or you're aware of the political, I mean, there's a lot of political parties. And my understanding is that what they've done recently is managed to put together what they perceive to be a workable coalition, right?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I'll be honest with you. I'm embarrassingly ignorant to German politics. But yes, they did put together a workable coalition from what I've read. How exactly that works, I don't know.
I think it probably with great skill, but the point is that, at least in theory, that basically everybody gets a seat at the table and a voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of democracy we have in Canada at the moment, even without a Liberal majority government, it's very, very difficult for anybody to be heard. And in the United States, because it's a two-party system, it's not a question of anybody being heard so much as it is of, you know, of one party getting control and sort of waging war against the other party.
I mean, it seems to me like the only democracy that I'm aware of that's functioning pretty well is the direct democracy in Switzerland.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting concept. By that, you mean one person, one vote. You just add up the votes and see where it goes, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of pure theory, of course, what many people would say is that, well, you know, this is why we need constitutional rights, you know, to protect a majority of voters, sorry, protect a minority of voters under the Swiss system from a majority. So I don't know, it's really messy. But what is clear to me, at least in North America, is that elected representatives are not there to represent their constituents at all.
No.
And there's a huge, you know, I mean, basically people are in these democracies, these first world democracies of Canada, the United States, you know, average citizens are completely locked out of the political process.
Absolutely. No, no, it's really becoming us versus them, right? I mean, it's created two different classes of people, right? You have the premier class, which is those in government, and then you have the rest of everybody else who's the schmucks who pay for.
Exactly, who pay for their pensions.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, I met this man in the last few years of his life, an amazing man who was a very, very career, but was a member of parliament in Canada for a number of years. His name was Sinclair Stevens. And, you know, listening to him talk, I mean, he had sort of a perspective, you know, of 100 years of first world democracy. He's a very, very decent human being. And I'm so glad that, you know, my own life that I had the opportunity to meet him, you know, as, you know, the last few years of his life, because he is thinking had a huge impact on me. But, you know, one of the things that was amazing, he told me that when he started as a parliamentarian in Canada, he was making far less, you know, I don't know, say $20,000 a year or something, you know, which was low even at that time than he was, you know, than I think he was even getting in terms of the pensions, you know, getting out of the thing. I mean, he was never in it. I mean, he had other things going on. For him, it was, yeah, I'm sure, not an issue particularly, but it is amazing, you know, how disproportionate the pension benefits from being in government can be to the actual time served and, you know, and the responsibility. I mean, clearly democracy needs to be reformed. I mean, given that, I think we agree that taxes are the biggest determinant of civilization, maybe we should set up a tax history party.
Listen, I'm in. You know what? Well, we need, but John, because this goes beyond the United States and Canada.
Oh yes.
You know, basically what we need, you know, for years we had the two superpowers, right? We had Russia and the United States that kind of balanced each other out a little bit. There needs to be a counterbalance to the goddamn OECD.
A counterbalance to the OECD.
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I was watching on Zoom a tax conference in India, and it was called 25 years of international tax or something. And many of the speakers had a perspective that was completely different from, you know, what you get from, you know, this part of the world. And so it went in the morning. In the afternoon, I was walking down a major street in Toronto after this, and a homeless person was there, you know, cold blanket and everything, and looked up to me and said, "Hey, what do you think? What do you think is the biggest source of poverty, the reason for poverty?" And I, you know, I immediately thought, I said, "Well, you know, it's these OECD and US tax treaties, okay, that impose all this inequality on the rest of the world."
Sure.
I mean, that might have been true in his case in Toronto, but it is true, I think, for, you know, many, many residents of poorer countries, which is why they didn't sign on to this whatever this thing is called, this pillar one and pillar two stuff.
Well, look, you know what I find so intriguing is, you know, you have all the OECD countries, right? The whole reason why they say all this is necessary is because of the income and wealth inequality, right? So they need these tax dollars so they can fix the income and wealth inequality problem within their countries. All the while, they're creating they're just increasing the size of the wealth equality between the OECD countries and the non-OECD countries, right? It's the most hypocritical thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, there's absolutely no question about it. And like many things in my life, I wasn't even aware of this, you know, until a few years ago when I actually started, you know, reading that people were asking the question, you know, why were people not going along with this, et cetera. And, you know, I mean, it's so simple. I mean, if anybody just took the time to, you know, understand it, I mean, you know, for 100 years, tax treaties have been used to basically scoop the profits out of third world countries, you know, by multinationals, depriving those governments the ability to use that revenue. I mean, you know, at its core, it's really that simple. I mean, sure, you can dress it up, you know, as all intellectuals do, but that's what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me that in the 21st century that this can continue.
Well, no, I mean, the West, the OECD countries can afford a great propaganda machine, right? I mean, they're solving society's ills by making sure that corporations and the wealthy pay their fair share.
Oh, it's absolutely ridiculous. And of course, you know, the most hypocritical thing of all is Secretary Yellen going hat in hand or whatever, cap in hand, you know, to the OECD kind of saying, please raise your taxes. You know, we don't want our companies, we want to raise our tax and we don't want our companies to be at a competitive disadvantage. Please raise your taxes.
It's actually totally believable. It's just sad.
Well, it is sad. But what's amazing to me is that, you know, they say this stuff and they seem to get away with it because nobody understands, you know, what they really mean behind it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that really should be taught as part of required education, right, in high school. But it's not. I mean, this is way more useful than biology.
You know, I think that this book, Good and Evil, I think that this should be replace great books curriculum at liberal arts colleges.
Yeah.
Or at least be included. I mean, if you were to go through this, you know, sort of a chapter a month or, you know, well, like whatever, you know, it, I mean, there's a lot to absorb, but I mean, you learn a lot about civilization, you learn a lot about history, and you learn a lot about, you know, how this leads to dysfunctional democracies.
Yep.
So, I mean, this is not a book about taxes, really. I mean, it's a book about, you know, how history evolves and how people, you know, keep making the same mistakes.
I mean, it's about the rise and fall of civilizations.
Yep, it is. Now, There are many books titled The Rise and Fall of Civilizations, but I don't think they really talk about taxes, do they?
What do you mean?
Well,
no. I mean, the big thing that the book shows is what a big force taxes have been on the rise and fall of civilizations throughout history. And what's interesting is, regardless of the type of government that it was, right, whether it was a dictatorship or a democracy or, you know, they've all fallen to the same bad tax policies.
Yeah. Generally, I suppose the result of, you know, wanting to spend more than they have.
Yep.
But this is also, and this is something we've mentioned before, which is why I believe so strongly that elected representatives, you know, of the ilk we're talking about, congressmen or members of parliament in Canada, should not be allowed to participate in tax policy. You know, I think by its nature, it has to be nonpartisan, and tax policy cannot be used as a way of weaponizing democracy.
Nope. And they also shouldn't be paid or get
all that too.
Or be career politicians or get a bunch of benefits.
What about the argument? I mean, I remember once when I was a kid asking, probably in my teens, why Paul, I think being first surprised to hear that politicians were paid, because I could see that they were getting all these benefits anyway, right? You know, and then, you know, the answer I was given was, well, because, you know, if they don't get paid, then, now this next cluster of words is, I think, the story of democracy and the story of taxation, because if they're not paid, then only the rich, you know, would be able to run for public office or something. And, you know, I mean, obviously, I've never forgotten the response. I don't know to what extent I thought it through, other than, now, you know, I can recognize bullshit when I see it, but, or hear it.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you think that that would be bad? That it's only the rich that are in political power? And the reason I ask, it's probably a very unpopular comment, but the reason that I ask is generally in my experience, one, the rich are generally fairly well-educated. And if they're not well-educated, they've been successful in business and things that, problem solving and things that that are necessary. They're job creators, they understand economics, but they're also a very giving people, like we talked about last week. They accomplish a lot through philanthropy. So it's not that they don't recognize the needs of society, including the less fortunate in society. So I can think of worse things than just the rich being politicians.
Well, I think that there's some truth to that. You know, of course, the typical response should be, you know, motivated by cynical assumptions that, you know, the only purpose of government is for people to enrich themselves. But I mean, in its theory, I don't actually agree with that. I mean, I have known many people who have been willing to run for political office without pay, or, you know, or obviously, well, I mean, when I was doing it only for, you know, primarily to further the interests of independent candidates. But I mean, I certainly wasn't into it for the money, that's for sure. To the extent, well, you know, actually, well, I was much younger and I wasn't thinking about pensions then. Now, if I were going to run for office today, I'd say, vote for John. He needs a pension. Something of that nature. Yeah. Okay. Well, this is interesting. This is interesting. You know, the last part of what he writes here, their price should be the praise they receive from fellow countrymen, job well done. Maybe this is part of the problem. Do you praise your elected representatives? Do you send them a Christmas card saying, please accept this card as my praising you for a year of service and congratulating you for a job well done?
Well, I've never seen one do a good job, so no. if I saw one do something intelligent, I'd think about it.
Uh-huh.
But I think that that's something that has to start in our education system, right? I mean, that's something, like with anything, that you have to be raised to do. And educated to do.
Well, I think that is definitely right. And it's hard for me to imagine. I mean, things are probably more cynical at the moment than at any time in my life. And I lived through, you know, the Watergate thing, the Nixon resignation. You know, I mean, I lived through all this stuff. And I think that people are far more cynical, even without any of that, those particular episodes going on. And, you know, I think that a reasonable conclusion from that is that democracies cannot operate effectively unless people have, I would, maybe faith in government is too strong, but, you know, they can't have such a distrust and cynicism.
No. And the governments have brought it on themselves. The politicians and the governments have brought it on themselves.
Well, you know, the United States needs a third party candidate. a strong independent candidate something. And to that, I would add a candidate who's probably in their 40s.
Yep.
All right. Well, great discussion. Great discussion. I'm not sure, you know, what more we can add. What about love for their country? Do you think people love their countries anymore? I wonder what David L'Esperance would say about that if he were on this week. Do people
love what? I think that based on comments from the time I was a kid until now, I would say that people do love their countries, but I would say that, you know, everything has its limits. Nothing's unconditional, right? And that I think that a lot of governments have pushed people to their limits.
Let's put the question this way. Do you think that people feel loved by their country?
No, hell no.
Especially these Americans abroad. Well, I think a lot of Americans abroad believe that the fact that they're taxed is an expression of U.S. love for them.
Yeah. I mean, it's paying tribute, right?
Exactly. Paying tribute in exchange for the love of the U.S. government. All right. Well, this has been a great talk for sure. To put this into context, right, we talk about taxes, civilization, and this kind of stuff. Taxes obviously are very much influenced by public servants, those who engage in public service or at least pretend to. And it matters. It matters if they're doing this stuff for the public good or for some other reason. And with all the lobbyists around, it's pretty clear that a very large amount of tax policy is just, you know, the result of lobbying and stuff that's not for the common good, but for the, you know, for the good of the people who are doing the lobbying, I guess.
Yep, I would agree with that.
All right. Where would people get a hold of you to get more wisdom and competent financial and tax planning?
EsquireGroup.com, or shoot us an email at info@EsquireGroup.com, or check out our YouTube channel, youtube.com/EsquireGroup, for more insights and commentary.
All right. Well, that's great. And next week we'll be picking up with lesson 8. And I've just got to read this one out. Okay.
I'm excited about this one.
Yeah. Here's what's coming next week, December the 13th. Oh, and by the way, December the 13th is also the Canada FACTA lawsuit appeal is being heard in the Federal Court of Canada. So I think that's a particularly good day for us to be discussing the following lesson from Charles Adams. Taxpayer discontent threatens the peace and prosperity of the social order more so than misbehaving taxpayers do. Consequently, the criminal arm of the tax system should be directed against oppressive tax agents rather than angry taxpayers. Does that remind you of at least the way the American Revolution is described in North America?
Very well could be.
All right. Looking forward to next week. Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks, John.